Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy. It won't be long. Healing rain is coming down. It's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy and tears of shame are washed forever in Jesus' name.
Good morning and welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. Welcome to the Thursday edition of my program. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. Many, many events are happening today and especially tomorrow. President Rouhani is here at the United Nations, and as we are on the air live, he has made his speech, and as soon as I get a chance to reassess it, I'm going to share it with you and give you my remarks. Many protesters have gathered in the Plaza Square around the United Nations, Iranians speaking out against Rouhani and the lies of his administration, the lies of the Iranian regime, the continued execution, the oppression of the Iranian people. So many events happening today. Also, we are preparing for the worldwide prayer vigil for Saeed Abedini. Nagma Abedini will join Franklin Graham tonight in Lafayette Avenue across from the White House. They will have a special time together. It's going to be live streamed. You need to go to Nagma's page and also to the BeHeardProject.com, and you'll see the live stream feed. I believe it starts at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And so there will be a special pre-vigil meeting tonight with Franklin Graham and Nagma and her family. And then tomorrow, of course, over 46 cities, over 36 countries joining in the worldwide prayer vigil for Saeed Abedini. So lots of events happening. And what I want to say this morning is what the Bible says in Psalm 47:2, "For the Lord Most High is awesome. He is the great King of all the earth." No matter what chaos is going on, no matter what evil events and intents of human hearts is happening, God is in sovereign control of this universe, and we can trust him in the worst and the most darkest of circumstances. What I want to do this morning is kind of focus in on this prayer vigil with Saeed Abedini and what Nagma has been doing the last 2 years that her husband has been absent as a prisoner of Iran. She has crisscrossed all over the country, literally all over the world, speaking in behalf of the persecuted church, speaking up for human rights, and of course, speaking out for her husband. But also, her children have begun to do the same. And just about 2 months ago, a very important little video came out. It was in English and in Farsi. It was called, "Dear Mr. President, Please Bring Our Daddy Home." And this was a video uploaded on YouTube by Rebecca and Jacob, two of Nagma and Saeed's children, expressing in, I think, their own words, their feelings for not having their daddy. And in light of what's happening in New York, and in light of the prayer vigil less than 24 hours away, I want to play this precious video so you can have a sense of how Saeed's children feel. And they are crying out for President Obama to bring their daddy home. I want you to hear it right now on The Cross in the Desert.
"Dear President Obama, please help bring my daddy home. I miss him so much. I want my daddy to bring me to Disneyland for my birthday.
I don't want to miss another birthday without him.
I don't want him to miss another birthday or Christmas or Father's Day.
Please help bring him home.
Why does our daddy need to be in prison for loving Jesus?
My heart cries because it misses Daddy, and when it sleeps, it cries, and it misses Daddy a lot, a thousand lot, and it doesn't stop crying, and it's crying right now.
Where is it crying? How do you know it's crying?
Because I feel it.
Oh. Your heart is crying?
Yeah.
Oh.
I pray that I'll come back home, but he's still not back home.
Your heart has to break when you hear that. I know that mine does. I don't have any children, but I can imagine what it would be like to try to talk to them while their father's not home. It would probably be the most broken, difficult thing to do. From the Christian Post, I want to briefly read this story about Nagma. She is scheduled to pray outside the White House for her husband's release, urging Obama to do more. She's going to do this Thursday to mark the 2-year anniversary of her husband's imprisonment in Iran for his faith and to urge President Obama to do more for help. Abedini, that is Nagma, will also bring attention to the plight of persecuted Christians around the world while prayer vigils in 493 cities in over 33 countries will mark the 2-year anniversary of her husband's imprisonment. A press release stated that the pastor's plight remains urgent as he fears and faces physical torture, malnourishment, death threats, and psychological abuse at the hands of the Iranian regime and fellow inmates, including those affiliated with ISIS. Saeed was imprisoned in September 2012 while traveling to Iran to work on a children's orphanage. He was then sentenced to 8 years in prison for threatening national security, according to Iranian authorities. It's been over 2 years. Amir Hikmati has been over 3. We're going to hear an interview with his family in a few short minutes. I want you to hear right now Nagma, who was recently on the Trinity Broadcasting Network, the Praise the Lord program. I think this was September 9th. And it's just a couple of minutes, but I want you to hear her share her heart right here on the cross in the desert.
First, I'm here to say that I am in the midst of my suffering, and God is so good.
Mm.
Hallelujah. You know, my suffering is not over. I don't know how it's going to end. My husband's in Iranian prison. He has an 8-year sentence for loving Jesus and for being a Christian. And, you know, since the day of the apostles, Christians have been martyred and tortured and killed, and it still continues to this day. Over 100,000 Christians are killed every year. Mm. Because they believe in Jesus. So it's something that most people outside of the U.S. experience, outside of U.S. and Europe, just for believing in Jesus. So he's in a prison serving in 8 years. I'm a single mom. I found myself in a situation I never expected, a single mom to 2 beautiful kids. My daughter will turn 8 in a few days, and this will be her 3rd birthday without her daddy. She was 5 when she last saw him, and so I'm here to say that you can be in the worst circumstance in your life. And like Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego said, God will deliver. But if he doesn't, he's still a good
he's
God.
He's still able.
Yeah. He's still a good God. You know, and I had to say that initially when my husband was taken. I had to believe that he was going to be delivered. Mm-hmm. But even if he is not, if something happens to him, God is still a good God. That doesn't question God's goodness.
Yeah.
That doesn't question the character of God. for me. And so I did grow up in a Muslim family. In Iran, there was a war with Iraq in the 80s, and so my twin brother was about to sign up. 6-7 year olds could sign up to go to war and go through mines, and the mines would blow up, and then the soldiers would go in. So my brother and
the children to clear the minefield so it wouldn't take a soldier's life.
Right. So my brother was about to sign up, and you didn't need parents' permission to do that. And if parents spoke out, then the government would throw them in prison for being against the government. So my parents were really worried about that. And me and my twin brother always, that's the start of, we were about 7, 8. We talked about, where is God? Who is God? Why we would wake up to bombs. We would go to sleep with bombs dropping, and wake up and go to school and see our, ruins and friends dead. And so we always talk, me and my brother, and where is God? Who is God? And why would he allow this? And we try to discover God the best way we could in Islam, and just do the prayers, do the rituals. I couldn't really get a sense of God. And through different circumstances, we ended up in the U.S. Before I ended up in Idaho, I was a California girl for about a year. I was in California for about a year. And one day, my brother, I think we'd been in the U.S. for about a few weeks, my brother came running to me, and he said, Nagmi, I found the God we've been looking for. He's the God of love, and I saw Jesus.
This is an amazing testimony. I wish we had more time to play it, but Nagma is recalling how she came to faith in Christ, and it began with the story of her brother having a vision of Jesus. It is an amazing thing what's happening in the Muslim world, how Jesus is appearing in dreams and visions to Muslims. And this is just one more example of how God is working among Muslims all over the world. It is mind-boggling. It is faith-building. And every day I go on the internet, I come across another story. And these stories are very true, because the Muslims in most of these cases are very strong fundamentalist Muslims in their faith. And because of the powerful visitation they have, they leave Islam. Now, you have to know something about the culture of Muslims to understand one thing. It is a very difficult and frightening thing for a Muslim man or woman to ever decide to leave their faith. There are consequences for leaving their faith. In most times, it's an honor killing. So these are very powerful visions and dreams for Muslims to leave their faith. It is not some Fig Newton imagination thing. They are actually encountering the risen Christ. Why do I say that? In Acts chapter 9, the Apostle Paul, one of the hardened critics of the Christian faith, who had Christians put to death, had a vision, a visitation of Jesus in the desert that caused him to walk away from his Hebrew heritage, to walk away from Judaism, and to serve the risen Lord. This same thing is happening today among many Muslims all over the world. And so we as Christians need to continue to pray that God will continue the incredible work he's doing among Muslims. And in fact, I have a story sitting here right next to me that's going to go in my new book, The Cross in the Desert. It's the story of, she's a new friend, in fact. Her name is Paymana. She is a refugee in Malaysia. She became a Christian just a year ago, and she shared with me her testimony. And how did she become a Christian after being many, many years a follower of Muhammad? It was a dream she had. It was such a powerful dream that at the age of 40, she turned her heart and her life over to Jesus. It's going to be in my new book, and I'm so blessed to have friends that share their experiences with me. Well, we've been talking about Nagma and Saeed and the prayer vigil. We also want to bring to you a very special interview now. Lisa Daftari, the Middle Eastern reporter for Fox News, sat down a few days ago with Amir Hikmati's family, his sister Sarah, and they had a discussion about the latest happenings with Amir, who is imprisoned in Iran over 3 years now. So we're going to hear that interview right now on The Cross in the Desert.
The family of Amir Hikmati, the 31-year-old Marine held captive in Iran, has traveled to New York this week, petitioning for his release as Iran's President Hassan Rouhani makes his annual trip to the UN General Assembly. Joining me to tell us more about Amir's case, his sister Sarah Hikmati, brother-in-law Rami Kordi, and Michigan Congressman Dan Kilby. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
just to catch everyone up, because I know there's been a lot of world attention on Amir's case, but to briefly talk about it, he's been held in Iran for 3 years. He's 31 years old, a U.S.-born citizen holding a U.S. passport, went back just to visit family, and this happened. I mean, what was your reaction when you first found out that your brother was going to be held, you as a sister, Sarah?
I mean, we were shocked, and it was disbelief. We contacted the Iranian authorities to find out what the problem could have been, because he went with all the appropriate paperwork, and he had a visa. He had applied for all the credentials through the Iranian consulate in Washington, D.C. So, I mean, it was very transparent that he was going.
Again, and I know that you've been in touch with lawmakers and others who've been petitioning for his cause, and you come to New York this week, obviously, as the president of Iran also travels to New York this week for the U.N. talks. I mean, what's your goal, Rami? You're his brother-in-law, very close friend as well. What's your goal this week? What are you trying to bring to the world's attention?
Well, our goal is not just to raise awareness. We have international support, domestic support, but to make a strong push for the president to realize Amir's case. His charge was cooperating with an enemy government, which America is not. Iran is now cooperating with America, so we want to push for them to release him based on humanitarian grounds, because there's only good that can come of it.
Now, is there a fear? I mean, now that there's ISIS and other types of threats and the nuclear talks with Iran that have taken center stage, and the human rights issues with Iran have basically gone off to the margin, what's your fear about that?
We have fears of any political climate. We have fears from everything, but the biggest fear for us is terminal cancer. His father has terminal cancer, and everything is nominal compared to that. His father's time is limited. He's always trying to think of getting reunited with his son. It's very difficult for him.
And Congressman, I know you've been integral in advocating for Amir's release. What can be done at this point?
Well, I think it's just important that the Iranian government understand, and certainly President Rouhani understands, that the American people are paying attention to this case. And the position of Congress and the American people is that if Iran truly seeks to become a member of the global community as a nation, you cannot hold political prisoners. Amir Hikmati is an innocent man, and he's being held for political purposes. So what I think needs to happen is that the Iranian government will see the opportunity to release Amir for pure humanitarian reasons on the basis of justice, but if not for those, as a gesture that demonstrates to the world that they are serious as they try to rejoin the global community.
Absolutely, and at this very important moment, Amir's father, your father, Sarah, is very ill, and you have produced a video to show the world what he's going through. If we can play a bit of that.
During this time, I suffered a brain tumor, a stroke, 2 or 3 times, and I've had a rough life.
Sarah, you're tearing up.
It's very emotional, and I know my father wishes he could be here to advocate for his son, my mother, too, but, you know, we're trying to be his voice, and he's there. He hasn't had access to his attorney. He hasn't been able to defend himself, and we just want to be his voice. We want the world to know that he's there wrongfully, and that we hope that we can reach the ears of the Iranian delegation while they're here, and that they can help us. We understand that they can reach out to the judiciary and support our cause, and we hope that they'll do that.
You're in New York, and the president of Iran is in New York. If you could speak directly to him, what would you say?
I would respectfully appeal to him, and I would want him to know that we really are pushing hard because our father is sick, and our brother went there solely to visit family and wanted to know more about his background and his heritage, and this has been a very difficult time for us. We hope he can understand that and reach back to the officials in Iran and do something about it.
And we know Amir himself is incredibly appreciative of all the advocacy and help that he's getting. He just put up, he got this statement that was put up on Facebook last night, in which he said, "Thank you for lifting my family up while I'm a world away, unable to be there for them, especially while my father has experienced many difficulties with his health. My mother also told me of the support I've received internationally from people of all ages, religions, and backgrounds. I want to thank you all for every thought, prayer, and all the effort you have taken to raise awareness and support on my behalf. It is with this that I hope I'll be able to thank you in person one day soon. Rami, what do you think about that?
I mean, that's Amir. You know, he spent a lifetime giving, and for him to receive support is humbling for him. He wants to come back and give back, and that's just how he thinks, and we can't wait for that to happen.
And Congressman, I'll end off with you. What can the people of the world do to further push for Amir's release?
I think they can raise their voices. Iran watches the world and knows that the world is watching them. So through social media, through any means possible, to make a plea to free Amir Hikmati. It's been across the spectrum that people have joined together to raise their voice for Amir. And I think if people across the world want to do that, it will make a difference.
And Sarah, how are your parents doing?
This has been a very emotional roller coaster. It's something you read about in the paper and you don't believe happens to just an average Midwestern family. It's been very, very hard. My father went from 3 years ago having his son in contact with him to him being in the midst of an international crisis, death sentence, now still in prison, and then him getting diagnosed with cancer, suffering 3 strokes. During this time, Amir had no idea, recently finding out, and he feels helpless. Amir feels helpless. My father wishes he could do more to help his son, too.
And I thank you all for your time, and we hope we can bring him back to Michigan very, very soon. For more on this story, check the family's website, freeamir.org, and you can read more about this story on foxnews.com. Thank you for watching.
Your heart has to go out for Sarah and for the Hikmati family. It is really hard to hear that interview and to not be emotionally react emotionally. Sorry, when you hear about Amir's father who has terminal brain cancer, and his son actually posted something on Facebook that is Amir just wanting to be reunited with his family, wanting to be with his father in his final days. And how can you not help? Not being driven emotionally by this. This is such a hard thing to listen to. And so the social media is the best hope for Amir as we continue to raise our voices in support for him. Being a voice for the voiceless is what I'm all about. So please continue to speak out for Amir. Please continue to petition for Amir. Please continue to support the family in this very, very difficult time with your prayer and your donations. They need your help. And so my good friend Sarah Brannick, who's going to be on in a few minutes, follows Amir and does a lot of tweeting and reaching out and being a voice for Amir. So it's really, really wonderful what she's doing. She's going to be on just a little bit later. Right now I want to take you to the situation with President Rouhani, who is in New York at the United Nations, talking about nuclear rights when the subject is human rights. I want you to know something about the human rights violations that go on in Iran, and let's listen to that from A View from Washington on Iran Human Rights right now on The Cross in the Desert.
And now, The View from Washington, an explanation of U.S. policy.
It's been more than a year since the election of President Hassan Rouhani in Iran. And despite his campaign promises, Iran's human rights situation has not improved. Hundreds of political prisoners remain incarcerated. Executions after dubious trials continue. The internet is still censored, and ethnic and religious minorities are persecuted. In testimony before Congress, Dr. Robert George, chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, said the Iranian regime's human rights and religious freedom record must feature centrally in any assessment of Iran, and the picture is bleak.
Iran's already dire religious freedom conditions have deteriorated during the Rouhani tenure, particularly for Baha'is, Christians, and Muslims belonging to minority Sufi and Sunni sects.
He pointed also to the plight of imprisoned Shia cleric Ayatollah Boroujerdi and the cases of jailed Christian pastors Farshid Fati and Saeed Obedini. Dr. George noted that dissidents and rights defenders have been increasingly targeted for the spurious crime of waging war against God.
But the regime's theocratic rulers are waging war against basic human rights of the Iranian people.
These abuses demand our attention and action, said Dr. George. And in light of the ongoing nuclear negotiations, he called on Iran to demonstrate a commitment to peaceful intentions abroad by ceasing its war at home against its own people and their rights.
That was The View from Washington, an explanation of U.S. policy.
The Iranian regime continues to involve itself in these serious human rights abuses, even as we sit here today, on a very large scale. We'll hear from one political prisoner here today in Iran. At least 750 people have been executed without due process in the past year. This is under President Rouhani. It is no wonder that Iran continues to stiff-arm the UN's special rapporteur on human rights in Iran. And I know that some thought that the election of President Rouhani might be a turning point. I would hope it would be. But I think we should remember that this is a man who called on the regime's besieged militia. He called on the besieged militia to crush mercilessly and monumentally, those are his words, crush mercilessly and monumentally the student protesters. More than a dozen students were killed in the protests in 1999. More than 1,000 were arrested, and several hundred were tortured. We should be speaking out against these abuses. For one, it is our moral responsibility to show Iranians that we are concerned about what happens to them as human beings. Unfortunately, I fear that the Obama administration's engagement with Iran has signaled to them that we are focused on its nuclear program alone. No matter how many innocent men or women are being beaten or tortured or raped or killed for expressing their hope for change in Iran. Of course, Iran's nuclear program is a paramount national security concern, but a focus on the Iranian regime's militant character is just as critical to U.S. security interests. How the regime treats its people is a pretty good indicator of how it's going to treat its neighbors. Let's imagine that Iran and the P5+1 come to an agreement next month. Are we comfortable leaving this regime with much of the critical nuclear infrastructure in place? How can this regime, which holds the noose in one hand, be trusted to hold the keys to a nuclear bomb in the other? There is a reason that we are more comfortable when such dangerous technology is in the hands of democratic nations, not hostile ones. And to be fair, the Bush administration, too, pushed human rights aside in its nuclear negotiations with North Korea. Members here on this committee who have served with me for a while will remember my criticism of the Bush administration at that time for that failure. But this failure to speak out against a regime's abuses, whether it is in Tehran or Pyongyang, fails to grasp the concept that promoting human rights, promoting democracy in Iran, and improving our national security, in fact, go hand in hand. And that is why I again want to thank you, Madam Chair, and for holding this hearing today, and thank Mr. Deutsch as well.
Thank you.
That is the House Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Royce speaking about the abuse of human rights in Iran. I played a video with some clips on Monday about the contradictions between what Rouhani proclaimed he was going to do and what has happened as a result. And Rouhani, in this video put out by the International Committee on Human Rights in Iran, Rouhani is saying on this video, "I'm standing by all my promises and positions I have announced. I take an oath, equal rights for all citizens." And yet, in spite of that and what Rouhani says, justice means no one is oppressed, we welcome criticism, Rouhani's remarks are clearly contradicted by the number of executions that have increased in the last year, over 1,000. Iran is still the second largest prison for journalists. They still do forced confessions on TV, state TV. Women are banned from entering sports events. In fact, that is the story I've been airing on my Facebook page with a petition for Ganache Gavimi. And Ghanacheh Gabbami actually, just this past June, went into a stadium in Tehran to attend a men's volleyball match. She did this thinking that the committee for the World Cup had put pressure on Iran to allow women in. She was under the assumption that it was okay in this situation to go in and attend, and later on she was arrested. Now she's spending prison time in Evin Prison in solitary confinement, and her brother is in New York where Rouhani is speaking to appeal to him. He's had many of his followers to tweet this event and to speak out for his 25-year-old sister, Ghanacheh. She is a British-Iranian woman who has been imprisoned in Iran for the last 3 months for trying to just attend a men's volleyball game. And because of the segregation of sexes in Iran, this is what's happening as a result. These kinds of punishment are handed out to people like Ghanacheh, who simply wanted to attend a sporting event. It's one more example of the women who are discriminated against and treated as second-class citizens in Iran. All of these examples I'm giving you are what the protesters are saying as they meet outside the UN protesting what Rouhani stands for. He may have a smile, but he's diabolical. He's deceitful. He has lied. He has broken all of his promises to help Iranians have more freedom on the internet. As a result of his promise, there is 8 Facebook people with over 127 years in prison for simply speaking their opinion on Facebook against the Islamic regime in Iran. And one of them is a lady named Roya. I have featured her on my Facebook page and have had a petition for you to sign to speak out for Roya. She also is a British-Iranian dual citizen like Ghanacheh. So here's what I want you to do today. I want you to go to my Facebook page if you're listening, and I want you to scroll down and find the petition to sign for Ghanacheh and for Roya, and please be a voice for these voiceless people. And this is what we're trying to do to reach the ear of President Rouhani and the Supreme Leader and crying out against injustices and violation of human rights and speaking for the voiceless who cannot speak for themselves. Right now I have my good friend Sarah Brannick, who is on the line right now, and she's going to talk with me this morning about the happenings in New York. Good morning and welcome to the Cross in the Desert, Sarah.
Hello, Randy.
Well, I'm glad that you came on the program today. I was just finishing a list of the contradictions of President Rouhani. His claim was that he's going to stand by all of his promises and he's going to make life a little easier for the Iranian people. And he even said in this video, "I take an oath, equal rights for all citizens." And yet, Sarah, you and I can look at what's happening, and really these are nothing more than broken promises, aren't they?
Yeah, it's shameful the way that the you can go see video after video after video of people being abused for, you know, no reason, really. They're just there, and they're being discriminated just because of their, you know, religion or their beliefs or their profession or their, you know, sex or whatever they are. They're being discriminated every single day. Every day I get on there, I see more, you know, public hangings for, you know, things we wouldn't even call crimes here. They're not crimes, and the people there are, I think that it's, you know, it's outrageous how it has so much, it's been exposed so much, especially because of technology and the internet, and, you know, exposed even more than, like, the atrocities in World War II, but in World War II, the difference was is that the, you know, global community stood up and did something about it. Here, it's like they turn away and they just ignore it.
I don't know if you had a chance to hear. I was having a little problem launching the chat room. They have a new version of the Blog Talk, and there are 2 ways you can get the chat to come up and turn on the sound and turn it off, and I haven't figured that out yet because they've redesigned things. But I wonder if you had a chance to hear the really emotional, touching interview that Lisa Daftari had with Sarah Hekmati and the congressmen that are supporting Amir's plight for freedom. I don't know if you had a chance to hear that, but I was just so touched by how they played the video of Amir's father, who was dying of terminal brain cancer. They played that during the interview, and Sarah was just so broken by it.
heard that, and it was, I've seen it several times now since they aired it, but it's impossible to watch it without feeling, you know, the depth of, you know, the tragedy of this whole injustice. All we want is for it to end as soon as possible, and I feel like the family, you know, can, they're not, the way that they talk, you can, you know, really, they're really genuine, like his sister, and you can just, you can hear it in her voice, you can see it in her eyes, any human can just, you know, feel immediately what they're going through. It's really, it was really powerful, actually, and like her, yeah, Dr. Hekmati's plea for his son to be able to come home.
Did you also have an opportunity to see the posting by Amir on Facebook that he was able to get a message out to all of them that are supporting and praying for him?
Yes, I did. And it was really encouraging to us to finally, I mean, after 3 years, there's been no word, like, from him. But since he's been able to talk on the phone, he was able to give his mom, I guess, a message to give to his supporters. So it was encouraging because he sounds the same, you know, like everything that you've heard of him before. And then the letter that got smuggled out, and then this statement, too. He sounds, you know, like he's still the same strong individual, and that he still is, like they say, the more punishment you take, the tougher you get. But, you know, he still seems like a very sensitive, you know, person. You know, he still has his, he's like very feeling person too, you know, and even the, and it, they're not like changing his personality, I don't think.
Now, you have spent an awful lot of time being a voice for the voices like I am. You're constantly on Twitter, and you're drawing attention to Amir's case. You talk a lot to people in the military. You've posted his situation on Twitter. You've really done a lot to help this family. You even had a chance to even have some communications with them. And how? What are some of the things they have told you?
Well, they say just to, yeah, bring as much awareness. They told me that I brought a lot of more support in. And I've kind of targeted just, you know, veterans and patriotic groups that are real into supporting the troops and supporting veterans, because Amir Hekmati is a veteran. And a lot of people don't realize that. I was talking on Twitter with someone, actually. I posted, actually it was Ted Cruz posted to bring Amir home, and somebody wrote in and said, yeah, that'd be good. We need to get him home, but we need to get our Marine home from Mexico first. And I guess they were giving him, you know, more attention because he served the country. So I wrote that person and I said, Amir Hekmati is a veteran. He served 2 deployments in Iraq and he was decorated in the War on Terror. So they wrote back and they're like, oh, that's my mistake. They're like, a lot of people don't know the whole story and they don't know like everything that he's done. So it's actually, it's a big job, like, to just go through and kind of inform people. And just every chance I get to find someone that's asking questions. A lot of people ask, you know, who is he? I've never heard of him. Why was he in Iran? What is this whole story? So it's you can just go through and find lots of people. But, you know, I don't think I can reach all of them, but just reaching as many as possible. And informing them and giving them the details, you know, because so many people are skeptical of other people, and they think if somebody is put in prison that, oh, they must have been doing something wrong or something, you know. It's not fair, but
well,
that's the way people are.
The amazing thing, Sarah, is that in the case of Amir, he was accused of being a spy, and a spy for Israel. And he was accused of all of these things, and all that he did was go to Iran to visit his family there. And as a result, he was put in prison. In the case of Saeed Abedini, he went there solely to help build an orphanage, that he had had permission from the government of Iran to do this. So it seems to me like in both situations with Amir and Saeed, we have the Iranian government coming up with some phony, trumped-up charges just to persecute and torture these Americans. And it seems like this is counterproductive. Here they are coming to New York, and they're meeting with this G5 summit in different locations for the nuclear discussions. They want all of this attention and cooperation, and yet they are holding American hostages in prison in Iran. It seems very counter to what they're trying to do. You would think they would spend some time listening to Amir's family, to Nagma's family, and begin to understand that how can we sit down with them when they are keeping our citizens in prison?
I think that they'll just go as far as they can and ignore it as long as they can. And if America doesn't bring it up, they won't bring it up. They'll just continue to hold those people. And so, you know, it's up to the American, you know, representatives there at the UN to bring it up. They need to bring it up. But if they don't, I think Iran's going to act like, you know, they're just going to play, you know, like they don't know anything about it right now, or they're not even going to mention it. They're going to ignore the whole subject. So that's why Amir's sister and brother-in-law and his congressmen are there in New York to bring it up.
I think if anyone's a student of history, they will remember back to the Iranian Revolution in 1979. And in November of 1979, some students at the university took our Americans hostage. And at that time, it was President Carter. And this was just an embarrassment that this happened. And President Carter really didn't do much of anything to bring them home. It wasn't until Reagan took office in 1981, January, that Khomeini finally recognized that this president means business, that he's not someone we can play games with, and they immediately, upon his inauguration, released these American hostages. So my question to you is, Sarah, do you think President Obama is doing all that he can do to bring our Americans home in prison in Iran? And will it take a presidential change for them to pay attention and to release them?
It'll either take that, or it'll take, I think, praying for God to intervene for them. And we've talked to people before. We say, how can they get out of there? And they say they don't see any way except prayer. That's the only solution some people come down to, that if both governments aren't going to do anything for these people are stuck there. Neither one. Their government isn't going to demand for their release, and then the government that's holding them doesn't want to let go of them.
I was sitting here reflecting on what you just said. It comes down to praying, and today Nagma Abedini, the wife of Saeed, is in Washington. She's meeting with Franklin Graham this evening. This preview of the prayer vigil is going to take place tonight, because it's actually not supposed to happen until tomorrow. There's over 463 cities there, 38 countries participating in this prayer vigil for Saeed. And she is going to actually go outside the White House to draw attention to her husband's plight and to pray for his release. That's the first time I remember Nagma going to the White House itself, standing outside the gate and praying for her husband. So as you mentioned, prayer is the most important thing.
Well, hopefully we'll see some results after so many people are, you know, coming together just for this. And I've seen people saying that they're going to the prayer vigil for Saeed and the persecuted church, but that they're also going to be praying for the other Americans out there. So I've seen some people telling on the Free Amir Hekmati page, which is run by, telling them that they'll be praying for him too, also at the Saeed prayer vigil. So I think that they should, actually.
Yes, I wish it was possible, Sarah, that I could have done this program on the day of the vigil, but like most of us that do blog talk, we have full-time jobs. But it's good that we can do this today to draw attention to the plight of these Americans. Now, you're familiar with what's going on in Iran, just like I am. And you've heard me talk about Rouhani and his claims and the things that he says he's going to do to make things better there. And we know he's a moderate, at least that's the claim, but we have found out from a historical standpoint that Rouhani really, really isn't as moderate as many, many would think he was. In fact, I was playing a clip from Chairman Royce back in 96 or 99, there was a student uprising movement along the universities in Iran, and Rouhani was quoted, crush them, crush the movement. So it seems to me, just going back to that time before Rouhani became president, that he really wasn't interested in the rights of students and was actually behind the arrest of these students in 1999. One of them was my friend Nazrul Mohammadi's brother, Akbar, who spent over 8 years in Evin prison and eventually was tortured and died. So just based on looking back in history, Rouhani is not all he's made up to be. He's a man with a smile, but he's very deceitful.
Right, and like our friend, we both saw his post, Pastor Don Farid, his post weighed a lot of, you know, it was really put really well. You know, he was saying that Rouhani is the face of his master Khomeini, the, you know, supreme leader, and that, you know, he you know, and he's in charge of deceiving and manipulating those who have hope to change the Islamic Republic of Iran, and they've, you know, been imprisoned and they've been, you know, executed. And also, yeah, he put it really well, actually. I can read part of it if you'd like.
Yes, go ahead and do that. I think that my friend Pastor Don Farid, who I had on the program here of Persian Ministries, he has a way with words. So go right ahead, read that. I think our listeners need to hear what Rouhani is really all about.
Yeah, okay. Well, his post said, it's a real good post, and it actually should be probably shared around. And he it said, time to be heard. Rouhani will be attending the UN yearly event on September 25th. And he, that's kind of like all the American-Iranian community goes sometimes to protest. And I guess they're protesting this year, too. They protested before. And they don't want him coming because they've been, you know, been forced to leave their homes because of the way that they're treated there. So, you know, and he said that they've been, you know, deceiving and manipulating, and we know well how the mullahs of Iran think. I personally don't see any difference between this regime and ISIL, the Islamic state. I know that even the whole world, if they bend and for backwards and forwards for this regime, they will continue to do evil because deep down in their core, they are evil. Like the Islamic state, this regime is beyond redemption. It is time to make sure we know how we feel about the Christians that they have in jails, the political prisoners they have in their dungeons, and the innocents they have hanged their hypocrisy behind the nuclear energy, their support of terrorism, mistreatment of women, stealing the national resources. So this goes on and on. Just be heard. And it's a little strange that so many people, even though, yeah, with all of the, you know, videos and all the reports and all the articles that come out of Iran, and that they still don't realize this. And if they do realize it, then they don't care. And I talk to people every day, like, on the Internet, and it's kind of strange because some of them, a lot of them are American, and I saw some comments, like, one guy, he's saying, like, our sanctions, he's acting like this is, like, bullying this country, and we're being, you know, sanctions are actually an act of war, so we shouldn't expect any cooperation from Iran to release any Americans. And then, like, another lady, she was saying that Iran is a peaceful little country that just wants to be left alone. So, of course, me and other people that, you know, understand that's not, we write in, you know, to show them that this isn't true and that these people are being oppressed and that, you know, there's already been, you know, hundreds of hangings over there just in this year. And they're just ignorant or they've got, like, an agenda and they can't be trusted either to be defending the Islamic Republic of Iran. And what they need to do is talk to some Iranians that are from there and find out why did they leave their country.
Yes. I'm amazed that people want to be willfully ignorant. I have a book coming out in a month or so, which is filled with personal recollections and stories of Iranians that lived there. These are my dear friends, Sarah, who have shared with me their stories of oppression and fear and discrimination. It's going to be in my new book, The Cross in the Desert. And so for those who want to post comments like that, I just want to share my book with them and say, here, read this. These are people suffering under the Islamic regime. And also for the Iranians that have come here, they are busy now in New York City protesting against this Islamic regime. And do you know what, Sarah? These are American citizens now. They're Iranians. And they could say, you know, I'm out of Iran. I want to live a different life. I just want to have a peaceful life. But no, these are Iranians that feel a responsibility yet to speak out in behalf of those friends of theirs and family members that are still in Iran. And they are Americans now, and they're saying, I have to keep speaking out against the injustices. So I don't understand people that post things like that. We need to connect them, as you said, to Iranians to tell them their story of what life is really like there. And this, again, is an example, Sarah. All we hear about is nuclear rights. The speech today will probably be about ISIS and nuclear rights. You will never hear Rouhani address human rights. If he actually talked about the number of human rights violations, then people like that that post things like that would have their eyes open, wouldn't they?
Yeah, no, on his Twitter page, he's just a vague postings about, yeah, the nuclear talks and how it will benefit, you know, come to an agreement and all. And it's just, they don't want to benefit anybody. They just want to oppress their own people and then probably start, you know, conquering or taking over or just, you know, annihilating the countries around them.
Yes, it's like my dear friend who lives in Tehran, who is a Christian, and she said before the election came this past June of last year, she says, I don't trust mullahs. I'm not going to vote, okay? Well, her friends came to her and said, you better go vote, because if not, you'll lose all of your government benefits. And so she reluctantly went to the polls in June of last year, but when she got there, Sarah, it's so funny because this is a story that's going to be in the new book. She says, you know, I'm not voting for any of these mullahs. I don't trust any of them. And she cast her vote on a ballot, a write-in. She put her vote down for Justin Bieber to be president. And I was just applauded her that she put that name down there, Justin Bieber, because she simply said, look, I don't want to be here. I don't want to lose my benefits, but I'm not voting for any of these mullahs. They can't be trusted. So instead, she wrote in the name Justin Bieber. I have to give her so much credit for being so courageous at a time like that.
You know, yeah, there's just no freedom over there for them to have to force people to vote for them. And so, yeah, for her to do that, she was just putting it in their face and saying, you think you may control me, but you can't control everything.
Yes. Well, with the last couple of minutes we have, Sarah, you've been hard at work every day. I know what you do. You're on Twitter and that you're speaking out for our Americans who are held hostage in Iran, in Mexico, in Iran, and also for the persecuted church. And you've been following closely Amir and his family. What are some of your final thoughts we can do today in light of President Rouhani being in New York? what can we do to best help Amir and to bring Saeed home? What can all of us do? And talk to that person who might be listening, who's not involved, who doesn't post a lot, who isn't involved, who doesn't feel as though what they say would make a difference. Talk to that person that their voice can make a difference.
Well, they got they always want people to share his story, and they posted just the other day, thank you, everyone, for all the sharing Amir's story. Together we are Amir's voice. And you can, yeah, go. You can use a hashtag. They just hashtag two words, Free Amir. And you can follow their Facebook page. And every day they post on their Facebook page, which is just Free Amir Hekmati. They post the, they have a fundraiser. So if you can, you can donate to the fundraiser. Usually it's on GoFundMe, but you can find the link on their Facebook page. They post it like every day. And usually the GoFundMe fundraisers do real well. So I'm not sure why, but some of them, they just need more advertising. So if you share it with your friends, too, on your Facebook page and encourage them to share it. Because he's a, you know, United States veteran, and he's already earned our support for, you know, just anything you can do to help. You know, he's already earned it. And his personal message, he just said to all of his supporters that, you know, every thought, every prayer, every effort means so much to me. And you know, he says it gives him hope that he'll be back in Michigan, and he'll have his family back and his life back, and he'll be able to thank each of his supporters in person soon. So, and that kind of just shows that, you know, when you hear that, it makes people even more want to help him, bring him back and see him get his life back. So
yes, Sarah, we are speaking out together and praying that Amir gets his life back. We are speaking out and praying that as a result of this worldwide prayer vigil tomorrow, that God will move on the situation with Saeed in Iran, and Nagma and Rebecca and Jacob can have their father and their husband back very, very soon. And that as we spend some time tomorrow on this prayer vigil, all of us need to remember the many, many persecuted Christians all over the world suffering for their faith. I want to thank you so much, Sarah, for what you do for Amir and for all persecuted Americans held in prison all over the world. Thank you for taking the time to be on the cross in the desert today.
Thank you for having me.
And have yourself a blessed day. That's Sarah Brannick, who spends her time tweeting, speaking out for Amir, on her Facebook and Twitter account. She does a fabulous job. I share a lot of her posts. She does a great job with pictures and telling the story of these persecuted Americans who are held abroad against their will. We've been talking today about the prayer vigils coming up, about Amir and Saeed and President Rouhani. But when all is said and done, we as people of faith can turn our attention to what the scriptures say about trusting God. And I want to read to you this particular scripture from the book of Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar was a proud pagan king who thought that all of the kingdoms of the world was the result of him. And God humbled him in a very strange and unordinary way. And at the end of his captivity, when he returned to his senses and finally recognized that God was in control, this is what Nebuchadnezzar said. It's recorded in Daniel chapter 4, verse 35. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of heavens and the peoples of earth. No one can hold back his hand or say to him, what have you done? Nebuchadnezzar learned a valuable lesson that God is the sovereign God in control of the world, that all events and all happenings are under his sovereign control. And even though we exercise our free will as moral human beings, God still is in control of our choices. He's in control of all of the events of this world. He uses our prayers to accomplish his purposes. Psalm 115, verse 3 says, our God is in heaven. He does whatever pleases him. Romans chapter 9, verse 20 says, but who are you, a human being, to talk back to God? Shall what is formed say to the one who formed it, why did you make me like this? Well, sovereignty means that God, as the ruler of the universe, has the right to do whatever he wants. Furthermore, he is in complete control over everything that happens. Now, as Christians, we need to carefully teach this doctrine because it cuts at the core of our pride. We somehow feel that we are in control. We somehow feel that our free will is what determines what is going to happen, but our God is in sovereign control. And this is a doctrine of great trust and great faith and great rest for those of us who are Christians. And what I want to do right now on The Cross in the Desert is to play a very personal song from Chris Tomlin. This is a song appearing on his Burning Lights CD. This is a beautiful song that will strengthen our trust and faith. It simply is acknowledging that no matter what happens in the world, God is sovereign. So let this song speak to your heart. Let this song build your faith. Let's listen to this beautiful rendition of the sovereignty of God right now on the cross in the desert.
Sovereign on the ocean floor, with me in the
Chris Tomlin from Burning Lights, a song called Sovereign, a beautiful song. All my fears, all my hopes, all my dreams held in your hands. It's talking about God being sovereign. And I'm thinking about the prayer visual for Saeed tomorrow and understanding and recognizing that our God hears the prayers, the cries of our hearts, and that he is sovereign, that he truly is in control, and that we can reach out and trust him in the darkest of circumstances. And we are trusting that as God hears our prayers tomorrow during the prayer visual, that he will work out his perfect plan in Saeed's life, that he will work out his perfect plan in Amir's life, as the God and the King of the universe, that he will use our prayers to accomplish his purposes. And we're praying for freedom for Amir. We are praying for freedom for Saeed in this very important prayer visual. I hope that you will take part in it tomorrow. I know that I will be there, and I will be supporting Nagma and her children in prayer and all the persecuted Christians all over the world. Such an important event tomorrow, September 26th, the prayer visual. Over 483 cities, 36 countries. Our God will hear the cries of our hearts. Our God will hear our prayers as we storm the heavens with our voices tomorrow during the prayer vigil. And also tonight, don't forget, go to Negma's page. You can click on about the prayer vigil warm-up tonight with Franklin Graham. It will be live-streamed starting at 6 p.m. Eastern time. And you can click on and follow that, an important event. Franklin Graham has done so much to reach out and minister to Nagma and her children. And this is an important event tonight. The title of our blog talk and the title of my blog is The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. Well, I want to feature someone right now on The Cross in the Desert, which was a great freedom fighter, a person of the past who fought for freedom for those enslaved. And I'm speaking of William Wilberforce. And I want to play this short documentary because in The Cross in the Desert, it's all about being a voice for the voiceless, being a freedom fighter. And I want to right now bring in the spotlight someone who fought for the rights of slaves in England. I want you to hear this right now on The Cross in the Desert.
The time had come. Men and women on both sides of the Atlantic knew that the horrible, degrading, and hateful business of slavery had to come to an end. The abolition movement grew daily in strength of numbers. They had all set for themselves the task of ridding the world of this crime against humanity. But how would they focus their energies? Who would carry their cause to the seat of government? One man came to see this work as his destiny. That man was William Wilberforce. This is his story. This is his legacy.
If you take the word slavery away from this whole story, what was it really about? It was about the wicked traffic in human beings. It was about the destruction of a civilization and culture in Africa and in the Caribbean. It was about lust. It was about greed, the huge greed that people had, not just white people, but also some Africans who were selling their own people for money.
There's a huge amount of money to be made from the slave trade. But the question then arises, I mean, how can you justify making money at such a kind of human cost? How can you justify the fact that the British want their sugar grown by slaves to sweeten their tea? How can you justify that in terms of the violence that's done to Africans? And not just to a few Africans. We're talking about the largest movement of people, enforced movement of people, until the Second World War. This is a huge, huge operation. And it becomes clear that it's based on violence and brutality of an extraordinary scale.
On Sunday, October 27, 1787, Wilberforce finally made up his mind. After church services and another long conversation with Newton, he wrote the four simple lines that have become one of the greatest personal mission statements of all time.
God Almighty has placed before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation
as manners. Those two objectives were to drive William Wilberforce, guiding him, healing him, and focusing all his energies for the rest of his days.
It's recorded for us. The guy was given to kind of bouts of depression, and he got down about life. He got despondent and despairing. Did Wilberforce know at the beginning of his campaign for the abolition of the slave trade, and that it would take him 20 years? And, he, you know, I'm sure if he thought about that, he'd think, I have no influence.
And he suffers what appears to have been his second nervous breakdown. Mentally, he was distraught. Physically, his health broke. He was devastated. Images of slaves in chains, in bondage, the horrors of the Middle Passage ran through his mind. He couldn't sleep.
But in reality, he probably was ahead of his time, because I think the environmentalists, certainly the abolitionists, those who voice various kinds of needs for freedom in certain areas, women, in almost every category, he probably represents the model for all of it. Though he has not been ascribed such, we can still look at William Wilberforce not just as a symbol, but as a human being who made a contribution, because we know where his heart was.
Wilberforce went to the House of Commons, and as debate began on the bill abolishing the slave trade, members would jump to their feet in bunches, in groups. They all wanted to speak on this great issue. It became apparent very early on that something very different was going to take place.
And at that moment, the House thought that was a wonderful point, and they started to cheer, and Wilberforce, overcome with emotion, sat there with his head bowed and tears streaming down his face as he thought that this act at long last was going to become law.
British historian Trevelyan describes the moment a year after the vote, and he describes this image of the West Indian Negroes on a hill waiting for the sunrise, knowing that the moment the sun rose, the moment that day dawned, they would be free. It's just an extraordinary image, and shows us that real human beings were involved in this. Human beings who hoped for freedom, who awaited the sunrise to celebrate something that they thought could never possibly happen in their lifetimes.
Although it was something without precedent, it became something that ennobled the British nation, called them, to use Lincoln's phrase, to remember the better angels of their nature. Wilberforce's power, the power of his personality, the power of his principles, helped change British life, and one cannot lay enough stress upon that.
I can so identify with William Wilberforce. He envisioned the day that the Negro would stand on the hill and wait for the sunrise, and their chains would melt off of them. I so identify with this passionate, great human being, because that's exactly what I write in my books for my Iranian friends. I've written many, many blogs where I say to my friend, for instance, Atafi, who lives in Tehran, I said, I'm praying for the day for a free Iran for you and your family, Atafi, that you will be able to walk down the streets of Tehran without fear. And I see this vision in my mind when I write that. When I wrote The Rose of Nowruz, I had this picture of young Bahira as a violinist, and she's walking in the fields where there are roses, and she's looking and seeing the sunrise, and she's free. And, of course, the rose in this book is a symbol of hope and freedom. But these are visions I see in my mind's eye, too, of the day when my Iranian friends can break free of the shackles of their chains. Now, maybe you as a listener can't really identify as strongly as I do. And all I can say is that my new book that's coming out, The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran, is probably one of the most important books that I've ever written. And here's why. The last 8 books have been full-length novels. 3 of them have been about the situation in Iran and their struggles for freedom. And they are novels with real characters, and it's the story of their struggle. But this book is actually them, my friends, on Facebook, on Skype, actually speaking to you, in some cases in their own words. These are stories about real friends. These are not fictional characters. These are stories coming from the lips and the hearts of my real friends that I've either written down in a story form about them or let them speak in their own words. And one such story is the story of my friend Maral. She is actually the first story in the book. And it's the story of our Skype one night a few months ago when after work I met with her and just interviewed her. And what made this so powerful was that I could actually see her facial reactions. I could actually see her eyes. I could see the emotions. It wasn't like that my friend Maral sent me a story and emailed it to me, as important as that was. I could actually see her react to the questions. I could actually see her face and what was happening when she commented. And I knew then, when I had this very special Skype event with Maral, that I had to do something more than just write novels, as important as they are. I certainly am not diminishing them. I thought, I wish there was a way I could bring my Iranian friends to my readers. Well, there is a way. And the way is this. Their actual stories that I have written down, or they've actually sent to me in their own words. And the first story is called Be Our Voice for Freedom. And it's my friend Maral. And I've written in italicized words some of her important quotes. And she says during the interview, Iran is one big. How I wish that Maral could be in New York. How I wish Maral could be there when Rouhani, her president, is going on and on about human rights, about nuclear rights and the things that are happening in the world and how countries should support Iran. I wish that she could come to the podium and in her exact words to me say, President Rouhani, Iran is one big prison. Now, I know the United Nations Special Rapporteur knows all about this. He's written full-length volumes about it. I know that the president there of the United Nations knows all about this. But why are we playing games with people's lives involving politics and nuclear rights when we should be addressing the most serious of all situations, human rights? My friend Maral says, the government chooses everything for us like a child. She says, the government chooses everything. We don't have the right to choose. And she says, freedom is our right. It is God's gift to us, Maral says in my first blog. I could see the tears in her eyes. I could see the expression in her face. And here I am sitting in comfortable St. Louis and talking to Maral in Shiraz, Iran, and it just broke my heart. So I wish Maral could come to her own president and tell her these things, except if she did, she would be arrested for complaining and speaking out against the Islamic regime. She would be in prison with the thousands of other political prisoners simply for saying to her president, I want freedom. She said to me in Farsi, she said, when you go to your book signing, Randy, tell them to be our voice for freedom. She says, please help us. We are prisoners here. Be our voice for freedom. I shared it with my customers. I handed out Iran 30 prayer guides to them. I shared with them the plight of my Iranian friends. And as always, I like to go to the Bible and to find scriptures to support what I'm saying. One particular psalm has become the theme of this new book. It's in my new book. And it's Psalm chapter 72, verses 13 through 14. And I want to read this to you because it's a promise about what God will do. David says, as he wrote about reflecting on who God is, he said, he will rescue the poor when they cry to him. He will help the oppressed who have no one to defend them. He feels pity for the weak and the needy, and he will rescue them. He will redeem them from oppression and violence, for their lives are precious to him. I love the way that this psalm is so structured. It's such an encouragement. It is a promise from the heart of God that he rescues the poor when, that he helps the oppressed who have no one to defend them, that he feels pity for the weak and the needy. He will rescue them, it says again. And I love the end of this psalm. It says, he will redeem them from oppression and violence, for their lives are precious to him. The heart of God says, your life, the very details of your life, are precious to me. You see, the very God of the universe is overwhelmingly in love with you. I have loved you with an everlasting love, Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 9 says. I have loved you with an everlasting love. I've said this many, many times again. I love what this psalm says, that our lives are precious to him. Throughout the Bible, we see God as a God of irresistible love. In the books I write, I make sure that I'm conveying this theme to my readers, because I want to say something to them about the Christian faith. Christianity is a love relationship with God. Oftentimes we hear the word religion bandied about, but that's not what Christianity is. Christianity is a relationship with his sons and daughters, not literal, but spiritual sons and daughters. In Islam, you're a slave to Allah. In Christianity, you're an object of God's compassion and love as a son or daughter. It's very, very clear. And this is why many, many Muslims are leaving Islam and finding their hope, their peace in Christianity. Because Christianity is Christ. It's about Jesus. It's so much more different. And we've been talking today about the prayer vigil and about the plight of Americans held abroad in prisons all over the world, especially in Iran. And we are talking about the power of prayer, how it moves the heart of God, how God feels pity for the weak and needy, and it says he will rescue them. I am very confident tomorrow that as millions of Christians gather prayers for Saeed and Amir and many, many other Christians held abroad, as we lift up our voices for the suffering, I know that our God will meet with us and will hear our cries. And as I've been sharing on this program, God is sovereign, that he is in control of all things, that he does as he pleases for his purposes, for his glory, but that he uses the prayers of his people to shape history. And so as we're meeting tomorrow, we don't have to focus in on what our government will do or not do, because we're focusing in our great God and Savior and what he will do. We know this as Christians. We understand this. As Christians, though, we don't see the whole picture. We're finite human beings. But God sees the entire picture from his perspective. And so on our side of heaven, it's sometimes difficult to trust. Sometimes we don't understand why things don't happen as we pray. Sometimes we question God, why? And yet we don't see the bigger picture. We don't see what God is doing from his side of heaven. And as Negma shared in her interview today that I played for you, even if God chooses not to free her husband, just like the cry of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the three human Hebrew children who were told by Nebuchadnezzar, bow down and worship this image, they refused to, so he threw them in the furnace of fire. And he said, that is, the Hebrew said, even if our God chooses not to deliver us, still worship him. He's still a good God. I heard Negma say that. I was so moved inside. She is saying, in essence, if God chooses not to free my husband, I will still love him. I will still worship him. He is still a good God. I've learned so much about the Christian walk with Negma, who said in my interview with her just this past August and the last August, we should embrace our trials. The reason she says that is she knows from experience to run away from trials is to run away from the heart of God, who wants to grow our faith, who wants to strengthen us, who wants to shape and mold us, who wants to use us in the midst of our trials and weaknesses, that we are a great testimony of his grace to the world. So she's saying, don't run from your trials. Look at this as an opportunity of great joy to grow and be strengthened. Oh, yes, it's painful. We all know it's painful, but it's God's way of shaping and molding us and giving us a testimony to a hurting world about his greatness when we embrace the trials. And Negma knows firsthand. Sarah, as a Muslim, knows firsthand the trial that she is going through when her brother is held abroad for 3.5 years now. When her father is dying of terminal cancer, she understands the reality of the severity of that trial. And so I would ask you, as a listener to The Cross in the Desert, please take out in your busy schedule whatever time you have tomorrow and cry out to your God about Saeed and Amir and all persecuted Christians. Spend that time in worship and praise to him. I know that I work 2 and sometimes 3 jobs, but I'm setting aside that time tomorrow morning and crying out to God for Saeed and Amir and all of the persecuted Christians. I just hope and pray that our faith is strengthened through this. I hope that our lives are transformed through this. And I hope one day I can meet my brother Saeed in person and just give him the biggest hug in the whole world and learn from him of how his faith was shaped and molded through his imprisonment. I'm sure he has a story to tell that will keep all of us spellbound as we listen to him share how God used him mightily in his imprisonment. As you well know, Negma shared at the convocation a year ago at Liberty that many, many Muslims have come to faith in Christ through Saeed's testimony. And so as we think about the vigil tomorrow and we prepare for it, let's prepare our hearts in a special way. Let's get before our God and cry out for Saeed, for Amir, and all persecuted Christians. I want to thank you so much for taking your busy time out of your schedule to listen to The Cross in the Desert. It is my privilege to be a voice for Iranians. Please be a voice for them as well. Please go to my Facebook page and sign the petitions and be a voice for their freedom. I will see you next Monday on The Cross in the Desert. Have yourself an incredible weekend. God bless you. I will see you then.
Healing rain is coming down, it's coming nearer to this old town, to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy, it won't be long.